We're on CR Homes, Inc. versus District Court. This is 55151. If parties are ready, they may proceed. And please state for the record your name and any time you wish to reserve. Additionally, we would note that we are without Justice Hardesty. He will review the tapes and be part of our deliberation this day. And Justice Seda and Justice Cherry are conflicted as to this matter.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Robert Eisenberg, appearing for the petitioner, C.R. Holmes. I'm going to attempt to reserve approximately 5 minutes for rebuttal if I can. The Court's order scheduling the oral argument identified two issues that the Court asked us to focus on. The first one is what the control date should be for purposes of Rule 41E, and the second issue is what constitutes a hearing or a trial for purposes of that rule. The second issue really is the one that probably has by far the most precedential value for lawyers and judges throughout the state. So with the Court's permission, I'd like to address that issue first and then get back to the second one, or the first one. And the issue really is we've characterized it as a sham proceeding. That's not a phrase that we came up with. That's a phrase that this Court itself used in the Lippitt case. But there are two cases that I would ask the Court to focus on. The first, Monroe versus Columbia Sunrise Hospital, which was written by Chief Justice Douglas 3 or 4 years ago. And that case defined what a trial is for purposes of the five-year rule. And the Court said that a trial is an examination by the Court of issues of fact or law, quote, for the purpose of determining the rights of the parties. So the court focused on what is the purpose of the proceeding. And the second case that I would ask you to focus on is Lippitt versus State. And that's the case where the court applied a good faith factor to the analysis. That's the case where the plaintiff's lawyer called one of the defense lawyers as a witness, asked a couple of questions, and argued that that constituted a trial for purposes of the five-year rule. And this court said, no, that was a sham proceeding, that it was really contrary to the purpose and the spirit of the rule and the case law. And the court said that that did not constitute a good faith effort to resolve the rights of the parties, and therefore it did not count as a trial. In this case, what we have is it wasn't a lawyer who was called as a witness, but it was one of the parties. But clearly, undeniably, the purpose of the proceeding on July 30th of 2009 was to avoid the five-year rule. And the judge even stated on the record that the purpose of that proceeding was to avoid the five-year rule. And then the judge told not just the lawyers, but the jurors, that they would be coming back later for the actual trial. That's what he referred to the future proceeding as going to be the actual trial. And then the judge stated on the record in response to defense counsel's objection that it was a sham. The judge said, if it's a sham, it's a sham. And he explained later on that what he meant was the record will speak for itself and it will be for this court, the Nevada Supreme Court, to determine on the record whether it was a sham. But we believe clearly it was a sham, especially based on the judge's characterization of it as a way to avoid the five-year rule. The purpose of the five-year rule, this court has said, is to protect the judiciary from stale claims and to encourage plaintiffs to pursue their cases diligently. And in this case, that purpose is served by determining that a sham trial, a trial where the purpose of the trial is not to litigate the rights of the parties arising out of the case, but instead is solely to satisfy the five-year rule, should not constitute bringing a case to trial within the meaning of Rule 41E.
How do we contrast that, though, to the axiom that we hear all too often, cases should be decided on their merits?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How do we contrast that to the axiom that cases should be tried or decided on their merits?
Well, that is a competing policy, but what this court has said over and over again is that Rule 41E is absolute. And this court has said that the equities of the parties and the sympathy for the parties and the need to decide cases on the merits, that is all subject to the five-year rule, and there are no exceptions to the five-year rule except if a case is stayed by court order. And so the court has essentially said that the policy established by Rule 41E supersedes other policies, and the rule is absolute. And so all we're asking this court to do is apply those cases that say the rule is absolute.
There's a cluster of cases that deal with this routine of calling a single witness. And I acknowledge that the Lippitt case introduces a good faith criteria into it. But in Lippitt, the witness who was called had wholly no personal knowledge. It was opposing counsel or something like that. Of the cases that are in this neighborhood, French Bouquet, Addart, Lippitt, and I think Smith, is there a difference in your estimation when it's a jury versus a non-jury proceeding with this calling one witness? And should there be a difference in terms of what we look at in assessing good faith?
In terms of the case law that deals with calling one witness, I don't see a difference between a bench trial and a jury trial. I could see a difference in the two types of trials in determining when a trial starts. For example, in a bench trial, the judge
You could take the testimony of one witness, and that could be legitimately pointing towards trial on the merits. Whereas in the jury case, you convene the jury, you pick it, you haul the people out of their homes down to court to be jurors, and then you call a witness who says a little bit, and you tell the jury, we'll see you again in 9 months.
Well,
to me, that's a different test, really, almost.
In the Smith case, they didn't even call a witness. In the Smith case, there was a confusion over a deposition transcript.
They lost it, but they started the trial expecting to read a deposition.
And the court said if the parties show up and in good faith and they argue motions in limine and they start jury selection, that's enough. I mean, in my mind, it seems like when the judge takes the bench, calls the case and says, are the parties ready? And we both say yes. And then the judge starts doing something, whether it's jury selection or asking the lawyers for to make an opening statement if it's a bench trial, then that's the start of the trial. But to get back to your question about the calling one witness cases, those cases, if you look at, for example, in the French Bouquet flower shop case, the court said one witness was sufficient, but there was no explanation. It was a short little opinion, no explanation whether that was intended to avoid the five-year rule. Whether it was really intended as a sham. In the other case, the Addart case was a mistrial after three witnesses, and the court said, well, calling one witness is enough. But clearly in that case, if three witnesses had testified, it was not intended to avoid the five-year rule. So if you really look at those cases, none of them suggest that calling one witness for the purpose of avoiding the five-year rule is sufficient and doesn't constitute a sham and doesn't fly in the face of the purpose of the rule and the spirit of the case law.
I have another question on another subject, and that is the Nye County action is filed in August, and we don't have a complete record here, but as I read the record, the Gaylor joins the complaint in 2007 and brings in C.R. Holmes. And then that action is severed out. And although it's not fully developed, my question is why would not that severance of the case between Gaylor and C.R. Holmes, neither of whom was a party to either the Clark County or the Nye County suit, why would not the five-year rule clock start running from the new filed case that got a new case number after seven?
Well, there are several things to consider in answering that question, and I'd preface my answer by pointing out that if a plaintiff creates extreme confusion and uncertainty in the record by filing multiple complaints in multiple counties, adding and subtracting defendants, adding and subtracting plaintiffs. The plaintiff should not be allowed to take advantage of that later on to defeat the five-year rule. That being said, first you had the Clark County case, then you had the first Nye County case, then you had the judge severing out Gaylor. I suggest that the way to look at the severance, the judge didn't dismiss the Gaylor case. The judge severed it. It was more like a fork in the road where part of the case took one road and the other part took another road. And what the judge said in the severance order is that the Gaylor case would be severed and assigned a new case number. He didn't say it would be dismissed, didn't say it would be treated separately. Now, the plaintiffs then waited, I think it was around 4 months, and instead of going to the clerk's office and simply having it assigned a new case number, they filed another complaint with Gaylor as the plaintiff with two other plaintiffs added to it. Now, what this court's case law has said says is that the word action is as broad as possible. It includes complaints, counterclaims, cross-claims, third-party complaints, amended complaints, adding defendants, amended complaints, adding plaintiffs.
Right, that, and if it had stayed just the Nye County case pre-severance, I agree with you. Johnson would have said Ms. Gaylor joins that suit as she finds it, and so adding parties doesn't make a difference. But the question I have is whether severance creates, in effect, a new action.
And our contention is that, no, it shouldn't. What the judge intended clearly by his order was it would just be given a new case number. And, in fact, if you look at the motion that the plaintiffs filed to set the case for trial and to expedite the trial setting, when they argued that it was the August 16th, 2009 date, they lumped them all together, even though Gaylor had been separated. That one motion included all the case numbers. And they themselves argued that it was that the target date was that August 16th, 2009 date because of the August 16th, 2004 complaint. And so our contention is under this court's broad interpretation of the word action under Rule 41E, that seventh order, at least in this case, did not have the effect of creating a new time limit. A whole new five-year limit is what they're asking for under that theory. I see I'm down to 3 minutes left. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time unless the court has any other questions.
Any additional questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, if it pleases the court. Let me address the last point that was brought up by Justice Pickering. Justice Pickering identified a very key factor that under Rule 21, NRCP Rule 21, it says without, by its own language, a separate action, it proceeds separately when it is severed from another case. So what we have is that when Ms. Gaylor's action was joined into the existing Bandiero, that was determined by the district court to be a misjoinder. And we have an order to that effect issued by the court, and it was based upon C.R. Holmes filing a motion to sever, arguing that the Gaylor context has nothing to do with any of the other matters that were in the Bandiero case because the Gaylor house is unique, built by someone else at a different time. That's the basis for the misjoinder. Now, the effect of...
The problem with that argument is that Rule 21 refers to a claim against a party being severed, not action, and action is the word that's used in 41E. I agree with you on this record. It appears that it was really treated as a separate action, but there's an issue there. There's a wording issue.
And is it a difference in wording of any significance? I don't believe so, because clearly Ms. Gaylor, when she came into the Bennier case, she had her own box of circumstances that she was saying C.R. Holmes was responsible for. So it isn't a claim that comes off of any other defendant, party, or issue that was existing at that point in time. So where does that leave us? Well, if it's a independent action once it's severed, then I agree with Justice Pickering that that then is the start point for the 5-year period for purposes of 41E. Now, there still remains a bit of a question. It's of no significance time-wise. Is the 5-year begin when she joined her action in to the case, which was December 1, 2006, or is it when the actual complaint was filed by Gaylor, Bradley, and Pinozzo on October 29, 2007? So the 5 years then, if you pick one of them, it takes you to December 1, 2011, or October 29, 2012.
How do you deal with our Johnson case if you're arguing for December 1, 2006, that seems to say amending the pleadings and substituting parties does not change, doesn't renew the 5-year rule?
The reason is that that's dealing with amendments that still have the core of all of the actions, whether they be an amendment, counterclaim, cross-claim, it all derives from the same basic issues that are common to all of the parties, whether they be brought in by an amendment, brought in by a cross-claim, or brought in third-party claim. So the Johnson case says, under that circumstance, it's the you come in, you're in there, but you have the date of the originating complaint at starting the 5-year. We don't have that here, as clear from the misjoinder. There is no commonality with any other issue in Bandiero.
Did you make this argument in the trial court?
Yes.
At what point?
Excuse me, maybe I misunderstood. In the trial court. The position I agreed in response to the motion to sever that Gaylor was misjoint.
No, my question was, did you make the argument that the 5-year rule clock should not start to run until either December 1, 2006 or October 27, 2007, because Ms. Gaylor's action against C.R. Holmes was entirely separate?
At that point in time, I only identified the October 29, 2012 date when the complaint by Gaylor, Bradley, and Pinozzo was filed. And that's why I add in this December 1 possibility. And that was consistent. The 2012 date is consistent with what C.R. Holmes' counsel in response to the motion I filed for trial setting of the Gaylor case, came back and said, that isn't necessary. The date, the critical date, isn't until October 2012. So we don't need a expedited trial setting. There's no reason for it. And I want to comment on something the counsel said, that I contended that August 16th was the key date. I did not. What I said was, I wasn't sure what the applicable date was, but in an exercise of caution and to ensure that my client's interests were protected, the earliest possible date it could be was August 16th. But now we know that because of the misjoinder, it is a later date. Now, where does that leave this court? You could, if you say that the trial did not commence, you still have the option of saying, I'm remanding it back for the trial court for trial setting, so that it occurs in a reasonable time before either December 1 of this year or October 29 of 2012. So that is an option for this court. It is my second option that I would propose, because I believe that your decisions over a 33-year period have made it very clear that what occurred in commencing this trial under 41E is in compliance with your decisions for the past 33 years. The trial judge, Judge Bonaventure, in the hearing on the first motion to dismiss that was filed by C.R. Holmes, made it abundantly clear that he did not think what occurred in commencing this trial was a sham. He also made it abundantly clear that he relied on the string of cases that you referred to that had been developed over 33 years to identify the commencement of a trial in this case. I also said to the court at that point, I relied on these lines of cases to commence this trial and comply with 41E. To now retroactively attempt to change that would be a disservice to longstanding precedent that this court has set. I recognize that this court can change the criteria prospectively. And maybe you might want to say they complied with the commencement of the trial under Rule 41E of then existing precedent and decisions of this court. But in the future, and I've seen you use that phrase more than a few times, in the future, we establish one or more additional criteria for the consideration of whether or not a trial has commenced under Rule 41E. That is an option.
What criteria do you think would be appropriate to apply here? 41E is trying to accomplish finality, and it does so on occasion at the expense of a litigant's right to have his case decided on the merits. But if you're going to remain with this calling one witness option, what criteria do you think are reasonable to apply in assessing whether that was legitimate or not?
It becomes difficult in that at the present time, the court has established a bright line. In other words, it's a discernible set of actions that commence the trial. If you modify it or add additional criteria in the future, it may open up more of a subjective second guessing of the trial judge in what he or she invested in the power to, you know, handle her court or his court does to commence a trial for purposes of 41E. So it can bring in subjective factors that no one will really know what the bright line is to comply with 41E in the commencement of an action. I'm not saying certainly you can do it, and maybe you're certainly more able to identify factors that would be of significance to you.
But what do you? Let's stay with the. You go. Just stay with the existing law. There's a requirement that the witness be called in good faith, that there be a good faith effort to get the case to trial.
Right.
What do you understand that to mean under the existing case law? What are the hallmarks of that?
Okay. The reference was that a witness was, the good faith language came into the case where a witness was called that had no knowledge about any issue or aspect of the case. And the court said, that isn't calling a witness that has, that is in good faith going to be able to assist the trier of fact in the trial of this matter. That's how I view the use of good faith in that context.
I'm trying to reconcile that, though, with Lippitt and what happened here, where you call a witness with no knowledge, and this court has said that that is a sham proceeding. And in this case, where you call someone with knowledge, but basically say, where do you live, and are you a plaintiff in this case? Why are you suing? And what's the distinction? I mean, what?
Well,
what do you suppose the policy there is, that one's okay and one's not okay? The Lippitt is calling a witness with no knowledge.
Well, Lippitt was that had no personal knowledge.
Correct.
And I mean, that's the black and white distinction. That's why the court, this court said, it isn't really of any consequence to call a witness in that context because the person didn't know anything. Whereas here, we do in fact have a witness called that has personal knowledge of the issues in the case.
But nothing was testified to. I mean, the only thing that that witness stated was a name and an address, and unless there's something more of substance, what difference does it make?
Well, it's
and doesn't it go, and when in Lippitt, they refer to the spirit of the rule. And what does that mean in this particular context when you're referencing the spirit of the rule?
Well, again, I think that goes back to the description of what's good faith, because spirit and good faith, I think, are kind of one and the same. That if you're going to call a witness that has something, some knowledge about the issues in the case.
And do what once they're up there?
Right.
And then do what once the witness is up there? Other than state their name and address.
Well, I mean, it wasn't from I tried to ask another question, and the trial court said, no, that's enough. Again, on the basis that Judge Bonaventure understood the line of cases that you could call a witness who gives testimony, and that testimony is the substance of what Ms. Gaylor presented to the trial court at that point in time. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I would like to address counsel's contention that it would be unfair to, as he characterizes it, retroactively change the law and apply it to this case. We don't believe at all that it's any retroactive application. The Lippitt case was decided more than 20 years before this case came to the so-called trial. And Lippitt said it can't be a sham proceeding. It has to be a good faith effort to try the case. And the Monroe case was decided before this case, and that case defined a trial as a legitimate proceeding to determine the rights and liabilities of the parties. So those two cases already existed. Counsel also suggested that that he somehow got cut off by the judge, and if he hadn't, he might have developed the case further when this witness was on the stand. Counsel conceded on the record that this case was not ready for trial and wouldn't be ready for trial for another 2 or 3 months. And our documents in this record clearly show that nobody was ready to try this case, and that counsel had even previously suggested to defense counsel that all he wanted to do was put on one witness. But the proof of whether it was really a sham proceeding is what the judge said when he said that the actual trial would occur in the future and that the purpose of this proceeding was to avoid the 5-year rule. Counsel also talked about the severance of this case, and when Gaylor was added to it, plaintiff's counsel had a choice. They could have filed a separate lawsuit for Gaylor, but they didn't do that. This record doesn't reflect why. Maybe there was a statute of limitations problem. Maybe there was some other procedural problem. But instead of doing that, they added Gaylor by amending the complaint, adding her home to the complaint, and then later on when they filed the other complaint, added a couple other plaintiffs. But they made that choice. And when they made that choice, the body of case law already existed that said that amendments to complaints and adding plaintiffs and all of those things don't have an effect on the 5-year rule, that the 5-year rule looks back to the date of the original complaint.
So you don't accept the misjoinder position?
I'm sorry?
You don't accept the misjoinder position they're advocating?
The misjoinder position was asserted, and the judge severed it, but like I said before, he didn't dismiss the case. He severed it and put them on different tracks for trial. And then the plaintiffs treated it as if, and he said, as I indicated earlier, that it would be given a new case number. But the plaintiffs treated it as one and the same.
Any additional questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. This matter stands submitted, and as I indicated, Justice Hardesty is participating in this matter.